Good morning. The Planned Parenthood sting videos continue to draw fire from the federal government, but are some lawmakers forgetting history? Today we'll talk with the regional head of Planned Parenthood for Hawaii and the mainland Northwest. And has there been any progress in the controversy over Maui's campsite for homeless people? We'll hear from the executive director of the foundation that made the proposal. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. Today we'll look ahead to a Honolulu Theater for Youth world premiere that reimagines a 150-year-old classic. Alvin Chan is the author of Anime Alice, and he's with us this morning. And Itamar Eichner is a senior Israeli reporter for Yedio Ahronot, who's writing an article about Jewish life in the islands. He'll share his impressions.
That's the conversation for Monday, August 10th. First, this news. Good morning and welcome to a Monday. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. This is The Conversation. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
You would be Chris Vandercook.
I would be, indeed. Looking at an effort to combat homelessness on Maui. Yeah?
And the ongoing controversy surrounding it. So we're going to pick up that conversation this morning. Now, how to help homeless people enter the conduit to permanent housing often starts with a shelter. On Maui, the whole Moana Foundation thinks that temporary shelter could be a campsite on a plot of private land near the entrance to Lahaina. Homeowners in the area don't like the idea and fought the proposal. Last month, the Maui Planning Commission gave the foundation 60 days to engage the community and try to work it out, though many of the homeowners, including the one we talked with on this program, would just like the proposal to move elsewhere. We thought we'd check in with the Ho'omoana Foundation to get an update on its progress. Lisa Darcy is its executive director. She joins us now by phone. Good morning.
Good morning.
As you've been watching this play out in a lot of conversation, a lot of letters to the editor over the last week or so, has there really been any dialogue beyond that with homeowners who find the proposal objectionable?
This is become a very large topic and not a specific topic. We are looking to engage based upon the Planning Commission's and the Planning Department's recommendation to have many more conversations with the residents within that community. So we will be having informational meetings definitely in the next couple of weeks. Yeah, and we've already begun to contact them.
The homeowner that we talked to, Bill Johnson, was of the opinion that there really isn't going to be anything that the foundation can do to be able to mitigate their concerns. How would you answer him?
Yeah, well, that gentleman and I have had an enormous amount of dialogue, and what we're trying to do with Ho'omoana is really actually pretty simple, and it's educate the community. We're choosing to do this through the proposal of the campground. There is enormous amount of misinformation that is circulating about individuals who are unsheltered, but also within this project. So I believe that once Mr. Johnson has seen the actual proposal, it has been sent to him. It really should answer many of his concerns.
Well, let's talk about some of those concerns. He says, for example, that having this at the entrance to Lahaina sets a bad tone for people who would be coming in to visit and that it's going to affect tourism.
Well, this project will actually not be visible from the highway, and we have put that forth with the pictures and the planning. There'll be burns. It's going to be away from the highway, so I'm unclear as to how he visualizes this as being, you know, like a welcome sign to Lahaina, because it actually will not be visible.
He said that they are also concerned about the issues of safety and security, and although that the plan calls for a resident manager to be there 24/7, that they still feel that somehow that's going to cause a bit of risk.
Yeah, and I, this is, you know, Mr. Johnson is actually our best supporter. If you really look at the most extreme examples of what people believe this community looks like, and he really is giving us a fantastic opportunity to demonstrate that the individuals that he is discussing are really a very, very small part of the entire unsheltered community. And statistically, they are people that will not be near where there are a lot of people or where there will be an organized facility. This is not a facility. It'll be an organized campground. But those individuals will not be interested in being near anything like this. So what I hope to bring out is the information that we are going to be working with individuals who are clearly, for one reason or another, in a situation where they might need just a little extra help or a little boost to get out of the cycle, or maybe they're not even in a cycle. They're really probably going to be situational or transitional versus episodic or chronic. He's really speaking about individuals that are chronic, and we recognize that with one on-site manager or two or whoever, we're not going to be able to work with that group of people. We've made that very clear, and I want to make sure that he and anybody else in the community understands that that's not the target group that we're going to be able to assist, and we recognize this.
You're looking for the people who may be down on their luck, who need a little bit of assistance, but who are clearly being streamed back into permanent housing. This also seems to make the point that there is too much of an umbrella that is over the idea of homeless people and not looking at specific populations. How do you combat that when we've been talking about this issue for such a long time and that there are so many different types of homeless people and families within the term the homeless?
So, you know, this is the core question, I think, that the foundation has sought to address. And certainly on Maui, there hasn't been a lot of proactive education regarding this community. And the term homelessness has been applied to everyone. But the vision of it is only this very chronic and really needy individual. But what we've been trying to do over the years, and I think we have done it because we are to the point where we're at the table talking with people, is we're here to identify that they're situational and transitional. And you don't really even see that group of people. They know how to kind of hide in the shadows, hang out at a coffee place. They might live in their car. They might be people who, lost their job and really don't have a place to go and are not comfortable necessarily even going to a shelter. They might couch surf. There's the episodic and the cyclical. That could be even, people who work in seasonal employment. So they might experience some type of houselessness for a short period of time, and then they're back to work. And then there's, chronic individuals. And those are, the ones that, of course, are most visible and have the highest degree of need and generally don't get any of their needs met. So what we've been trying to do for the last 6 years is really bring this education out from within just our little group that works together at the Maui Homeless Alliance, but really bring it to the community, the broader community, to help them understand that this is a very diverse group of people with a very diverse skill set, very diverse abilities that are actually could be even working in the community next to you, side by side, and they might be living in their car, and they're not going to talk about it because of the stigma that's associated, because there's such a stigma associated with being the term homeless versus houseless. So we haven't had a lot of promotion of education.
Okay, Lisa, can I ask you a quick question? Because I know we're going to have to go in a minute.
Oh, yeah.
With everything that you've said and the fact that there still seems to be this great fear surrounding that word homelessness and homeless people being glommed in together to one big group, how do you expect to be able to diffuse some of that fear enough to be able to see a project like this through?
Well, it is a big task, no doubt. And what we are trying to do is first of all, I recognize that even the smallest changes that Ho'omana has initiated, they take sometimes 2, 3, 4 times or, attempts at education and really demonstrating. I think the key is for this community to welcome individuals who have been unsheltered, to get up and to be able to say, listen, this is what I've gone through. This is what I've experienced. I'm actually a great person. I think it's going to really take individuals to be brave and bold and courageous and to stand up and say, I've become successful and I had this glitch in my life.
Well,
That's not an easy task, but I'm up for it.
All right. Well, thank you so much. We'll be checking back to see how things are going with you and with the community when you have your first meetings. Thanks so much for joining us this morning.
You're welcome. Thanks for having us.
Lisa Darcy is on the state board of the Hawaii Public Housing Authority and the executive director of the Ho'omoana Foundation. The private operating foundation assists individuals who are unsheltered to find safe housing and employment. Its proposal to create a campsite for the homeless in Lahaina is still being discussed with the community.
This is The Conversation on member-supported HPR2. It's 8:15, and coming up, why the bright colors of Japanese anime are right at home in Alice's Wonderland. But first, your quiz.
In today's backyard quiz, we're thinking about the worldwide explosion of anime, the Japanese version of comic art that has become a worldwide phenomenon. It caught on like crazy in Hawaii, where a generation of aspiring artists has gone from doodling on the school binders to prosperous careers. This morning, we're looking back to a surprisingly successful convention held at Honolulu's Alamono Hotel in 2005. Anime artists from Hawaii, Japan, and a few other countries took part in the three-day celebration. Anime enthusiasts called otaku, a Japanese word for fans with obsessive interests, and the flyer for this first anime convention in Hawaii read, quote, "We create a safe space for otaku to meet, socialize, and enjoy themselves. Anime has had an impact on our lives, and we want to be able to share that with others," end quote. Today, we're looking for the name of the convention from a decade ago that gave a running start to anime in Hawaii. You can call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. If you're first and right, you get the HPR t-shirt.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Honolulu Board of Water Supply, protecting and managing Oahu's drinking water resources. Learn 7 ways to save water at boardofwatersupply.com.
The most durable children's stories are the ones that appeal equally to adults, as we'll be reminded many times during this 150th anniversary of Lewis Carroll's classic Alice's Adventures in Wonderland. The work itself is an invitation to free your imagination, and play creator Alvin Chan has done just that with Anime Alice, a Honolulu Theater for Youth world premiere that draws on a cartoon and comic book world of imagery and style that was born in Japan before it spread around the world. Alvin is with us this morning. Good morning, Alvin.
Good morning, Chris. Thank you for having me.
Sure. What are the things that make anime a good fit for Alice and vice versa?
That's such a good question. Well, I mean, with Alice, it's such a story that has so many different colors and so many different characters and locales, and it's always looked on as this untouchable, weird story that's very trippy and psychedelic.
Yeah.
And when I think about trying to do that story on stage, I try to think about a form that allows that kind of freedom of expression to go all over the place, as well as to be able to stage it. And in my head, as soon as I thought of that story, I thought anime would be the only way to stage it in a way that was both cool and also relatable.
Yeah, because if you took a totally traditional way to stage it, that really wouldn't be the spirit of Lewis Carroll, who was kind of saying, get crazy.
Right, yeah. And he was saying, like, as long as you have your imagination and that wide-eyed, childlike outlook on things, then you can be resilient and you can go through any situation.
Yeah.
And, to approach it with a regular theatrical Western point of view, I don't think we'd be able to do the crazy things that are needed to make the characters really stand out in this story.
One of the things that, you know, my memory of Alice is as this young girl who has the suspicion that a lot of kids have, which is that the adult world is crazy, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And as she encounters the adult world, she finds out that, yes, in fact, it is kind of crazy.
Yeah.
So in a way, it's okay to think that. Do you see it kind of that way?
I think there are totally those themes in there. We talk about eat me and drink me and all these things, you know, she keeps growing and shrinking and changing. And just as a kid, you know, you're one size one day, you're another size the other day.
Yeah.
And you don't know what the rules are in these worlds. And you're constantly being told by different adults. Let's say Uncle Joe says, oh, you can eat snacks on the sofa, but Auntie, you know, Rhonda is like, no, you cannot eat snacks on the sofa. And as a child, you're like, wait, I don't understand.
Which is it, right?
Why do these rules keep changing? And from one adult to the other. And finally, you realize, well, it's not an absolute rule. And so maybe these rules aren't as important as I thought they were.
Uh-huh.
When they were first being explained to me.
Maybe it depends on the adult you ask,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm. But as a child, you just have to have that resiliency of saying, okay, this is the way it is here. This is the way it is here, and I'll figure it out later.
Visually, how do you make it an anime production?
Well, that's definitely in the costumes first.
Yeah.
Our Alice definitely has, you know, bright blonde hair and huge eye makeup with false eyelashes and things
uh-huh.
like that. And there's also very popping colors. And we also use it in the set. What we've tried to do with set was go with a manga approach, which is Japanese comic books,
yeah.
and try to fuse the comic nature with the animation nature of it. So we do have projections and whatnot, but also, let's say, the White Rabbit's house is actually a huge 2D drawn house that opens kind of like a puzzle piece, but it's a 2D puzzle piece. And so on the inside, you see a 2D drawing, cartoonish drawing of the inside of a rabbit's house. But just like a paper magic book, when you pull a tab, you know, a giant eyeball pops out of the window and you're just like, whoa, what is that?
So in a way, I mean, you're asking the kids to sort of go to that borderline between what is, you're deliberately not making it too real, I guess is what
yes,
I'm saying.
Yes, definitely. There's a bunch of stagehands all dressed in black. There's about three of us
uh-huh.
that play all the other characters other than Alice.
Uh-huh.
And yet we're also on stage the whole time. And if we're all in black, we're supposed to be invisible. So if she needs to have something float to her, you just have this invisible ninja float this prop to her. And she's like, oh, it's a cake. I think I'll eat it. As well as when she's falling down the rabbit hole, per se, all we have to do is pick her up and swing around in all these different directions. And she's falling this way and she's falling that way.
Uh-huh. Well, that's great, you know, because in theater, you're always asking people to suspend their disbelief
mm-hmm.
in various ways, right? Pretend that this is the Battle of Agincourt or
right.
whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And is that easier with kids to get them to sort of obey a theatrical convention? You're not supposed to see these guys, but you can see these guys?
Yes and no.
Uh-huh.
Well, I mean, kids can spot a mistake from 1,000 miles away. And if you're not being honest with them, they'll call you on it. They'll just be like, that's wrong. Or they'll say, that's boring.
Wow.
And so I think as a storyteller, if you're wise enough to set up the world and say, hey, kids, this is the world we're telling you this story in. Are you okay with that? And then they'll say something like, okay, I can get behind that.
Uh-huh.
Then you're golden the rest of the way.
But you got to get that permission, that understanding.
I think so. You need to set it up the right way. And so in the very beginning of our show, we have these stagehands come on and say, hey, you know, when we're black, we're invisible. Is that okay? Can you wrap your minds around that? Cool.
So you're very specific about that, the understanding that you want in that particular case.
Yeah, totally.
Suspend your disbelief in this area, but not necessarily in others, right?
Yes, yes. I mean, and especially in Alice, you know, like words pop out of a book and they're suspended in the air and it says something like, good morning, and another one says salutations, you know.
Uh-huh.
And the thought is using the humorous aspect of it, that we can set it up with a joke with these ninja stagehands so that the kids are like, all right, that's okay. I'm cool with that. One's holding a tree. He's the tree. And then as the play goes along, it just kind of gets nuts and perspective shifts and you see these stagehands doing crazy things. And we're always with a blank expression on our face to show that we're not in the scene. So if I'm holding a tree, I'm just like that. But as soon as the tree starts to talk, your face animates from that to like, yeah, you know. And
it just sounds like so much fun, Alvin.
It's a lot of fun. And today is actually the first day that we're having children in our audience. And so we haven't been getting used to the laughter aspect of it. And a lot of the adults who watch it just say, oh, that was really charming. Whereas I think the kids are just going to go bonkers.
Yeah. Well, I understand now what you said to me when you first came in, which is that you won't really know until you've shown it to kids.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, I bet you they'll like it, Alvin. Thanks so much.
No problem, Chris.
Alvin Chan is the author of Anime Alice and Her Adventures in Wonderland, the play that opens Honolulu Theater for Youth's 61st season. It's a world premiere, and opening night is this Friday, the 14th, 7 p.m. at Tenney Theater on the grounds of the Cathedral of St. Andrew. The play continues on Saturdays through September 19th. You can learn more on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Earth's 10-day forecast.
We only get one home. We only get one planet. There's no plan B.
There are only 10 more official negotiating days to talk about plan A before world leaders meet in Paris. Next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, right after The Conversation.
HBR brings you in-depth reporting from sources around the globe and from our own award-winning news team, the largest radio newsroom in Hawaii. We thank well-informed listeners June and Glenn Matsumoto of Honolulu, Barbara Trecker of Kihei, and Mark Service of Honolulu for choosing to support this station with their membership. Make HBR your current affair. Become a member today by calling us at 955-8821 during business hours or visit hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for today's programming comes from the BIA Remodel It Right Expo, with products, services, and trends for home building, remodeling, and energy savings. Friday, Saturday, and Sunday at the Blaisdell. BIAHawaii.org.
Medical cannabis dispensaries won't be open for another year, and the competition for the 8 licenses will be keen. That's why some business investors are already moving toward the money. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair is back with a reality check. Good morning.
Good morning and happy Monday, Beth Ann.
You too. Well, not like this wasn't expected. I mean, this looks like it's going to be a very lucrative business, but as opposed to just being a cash crop, should this be looked at a little differently?
Yeah, Anita Hofschneider really took a deep dive on the potential for the medical cannabis market here, and it could be really something else, because it's more than just growing and then selling the marijuana to qualified patients. There's a whole lot of other stuff that goes with that. I mean, think about it. It includes real estate, right? You got to have a place to not only grow the marijuana, but sell it, a retail store. So certainly there's an agricultural component. You got to have security, right? I mean, this is still an illegal drug in terms of, you know,
most
marijuana
people.
For exactly. And so you're going to have some sort of security involved. There's insurance for businesses and lawyers. Anita checked out and find out that already consulting fees are being charged. So this could be a big business. How big? Well, Pacific Business News had a recent estimate that maybe it'd be about $30 million annually. But Anita, talking to folks, thinks it actually could be a lot more. It is, in fact, the fastest growing industry, medical marijuana, nationwide. Are you ready? $2.7 billion. Mm. That's how big that industry is.
Now, when Pacific Business News did their calculation that said they thought that sales, or at least potential sales, would be like $30 million annually, that was based on a couple of assumptions. One, that we had 13,000 patients and that the average cost for an ounce of marijuana would be about $200 per month. But there are other
right.
places in the country where that's a lot more than $200 a month.
Exactly. I'll take both of those issues. First, those patients. We have 13,800 that are qualified. They're registered. They carry a medical marijuana card. But Anita's talked to folks that says, you know, that could actually double, because the whole problem all along in Hawaii, even though we have medical marijuana, there hasn't been a place to get it. You know, you really have to go black market or grow your own. So that's one thing. And another thing is, think about how expensive it is to run a business here in Hawaii, particularly real estate, rental costs, and electricity. So $200 for an ounce seems awfully low. Those figures have not, pricing figures have not been set yet, but one could imagine that it could be much more expensive than that.
And even now, looking at some of the other states, I think in Illinois, it's, what, $400 an ounce is expected to hopefully for some who are saying that, yeah, we want to make this into a business, so that's going to be what they'll charge.
That's right. And remember that Hawaii is known, at least black market-wise, as a very good place for marijuana. So one wonders whether that quality will spill over into the medical cannabis arena. It's going to be a big deal. We'll see. So already there are people putting together partnerships, raising money, and getting their act together so that they have the best chance to be one of those eight Hawaii licensees to grow medical marijuana.
Right. Clearly they are expecting that this is going to be a boom business. Thanks, Chad.
Thanks, Bethann.
Talk to you in the morning. Chad Blair writes for civilbeat.com.
Good morning. I'm Susan Arnett from the State Office of the Public Defender. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Tonight at 5, it's The Body Show with Dr. Kathy Kozak. And Kathy's got some information for new mothers, as I understand it.
You got it. We all got here somehow. And, you know, there's a lot of women who have just had babies, and they're just kind of wondering, what are some of the health consequences to their body? What's normal? What's not? And what can they do to take the best care of their newborn?
It's got to be almost overwhelming for that first-time mother, yeah?
Absolutely, and I'm sure all of us know somebody who's in this situation. So we're going to talk with an OBGYN about what are some of the expectations that women should have, and how can the rest of us help those new moms, or even the moms of their second, third, or fourth child, to really learn what's best for them and what's best for their baby, and what we can all do to help them out.
Well, what are some of the things that are available? What can people do, can medical professionals do?
You know, in the medical world, we can really help set the expectations. There's going to be changes to the body. There's going to be changes to the sleep patterns. We can let people know what other folks have done to help handle that, but also just the information. If you know you're going to have a certain consequence after giving birth, then at least you can expect it and realize what's normal and maybe what's not.
You know, an awful lot of information to be gathered, Kathy.
Sounds you got it.
Sounds like a good show. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
That's The Body Show with Dr. Kathy Kozak tonight at 5.
By this point, you've likely seen the Planned Parenthood sting videos made public by the anti-abortion group Center for Medical Progress. The initial video showed a Planned Parenthood official lunching and discussing the sale of fetal tissue to representatives from a purported research company. As we went into last weekend, a letter released by the U.S. House of Representatives Committee targeted several officials from the Women's Health Organization and three biomedical companies for investigation. Today, Christine Charbonneau, the original head of the newly merged Planned Parenthood of the Great Northwest and the Hawaiian Islands, is in Honolulu. She joins us now. Good morning. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Now, both those edited versions of all those videos, as well as some of the whole videos, are available online. Planned Parenthood have said that, you know, what initially came out was the edited version. It presented a very different discussion than what the whole video shows. Nevertheless, the senior director of medical services seems to be rather cavalier, mm-hmm. and sometimes even callous in the way she's discussing this. Now, given the fact that fetal tissue has been used for decades and was regulated and authorized again with the 1993 National Institutes of Health Revitalization Act, was that something that was more generated by her activities and about her attitude than by real facts that a lot of people should be very, very upset about?
I absolutely think that the facts don't support people being upset. I think that it's jarring for those of us who aren't medical to hear medical professionals talk about healthcare things in sort of a disembodied kind of way.
Literally.
You know, I have organ donor written on my driver's license, and I know here in Hawaii many people elect to be organ donors too. And I guess I never thought about that somewhere there must be a room where someone is talking about who needs what and how it's going to get there. And about, you know, if I were in an accident, you know, donating the eyes out of my skull. And I realized when I watched that many medical professionals, I think, talk that way because I think it's a defensive posture. If I were the person that was having to take the eyes or the heart or the lungs out of Chris Charbonneau after her accident to give them on to people who hopefully would live great lives after that, I'm not sure that they would want to know my hopes and dreams and that they would talk about me in sort of a holistic kind of way. I think that would be very difficult for those folks. That said, we don't want people to believe that Planned Parenthood folks are callous and that we don't care. I happen to know that doctor quite well, and I know that that's not where she comes from. She actually began the practice of medicine in her own life because she actually saw a woman die in a hospital. And it was such a galvanizing moment for her that she decided to dedicate her life to something which is quite risky for the people who do it. And so, you know, I guess that knowing that about her, I can readily understand how this is sort of a not typical view of her that one might take.
Your discussion about how doctors talk about these things and that, you know, they have their own way of dealing with mm-hmm. it may be more difficult for people to understand when we're talking about babies, mm-hmm. and particularly when you lay that over the anti-abortion movement. But the underpinnings of all this with the fetal tissue is that there is a historical precedent for this that goes back decades, even right. going back to the days of looking for the polio vaccine. Mm-hmm. Why is it that seems not to be part of the greater conversation?
Well, I think it's very inconvenient to have it be part of the greater conversation because many of the people who are at this moment calling for the defunding of Planned Parenthood over these videos were the same folks that voted in favor of fetal tissue research back in the day when this issue was brought up. At question here is not whether abortion is legal or whether people make the right decisions about those things or not. The only issue we're actually talking about here is whether that tissue should be wasted or whether some of it might go into science that might actually help someone after the fact. At Planned Parenthood of the Great Northwest and the Hawaiian Islands, we don't have a program for donating fetal tissue in any of our four states, so not Hawaii, not Alaska, not Washington, not Idaho. But the reason we don't is not because we disapprove of it, because I think that there's no question that fetal tissue research has led to a great many life-saving discoveries, and people with Parkinson's and MS and a number of other horrific maladies that might be helped by this would be helped by this. Breast cancer research has been vastly advanced through this methodology. So when we began to do the procedures that might lend themselves to being donated, the fact of the matter was science had enough samples. And they said, no, thank you. We have everything we need to do the research we need. So it's not an option we can offer to women. And for some women, the only reason we asked about doing it was for some women, they like the idea of something good coming out of what for them was a difficult situation. So people call us sometimes and say, if I were to have this procedure done with you, could I donate this for science? And the answer for us, unfortunately, is no. And we do refer our clients for whom that is a really important thing to be able to do to other providers. Now, to my knowledge, there is no research done with fetal tissue in Hawaii. So there really wouldn't be anywhere, I don't believe, to send anyone here.
Chris Charbonneau, for a long time there were many controversies that were swirling around the lineage of various stem cells, mm-hmm. and whether stem cells should be even used in research. And then right. There was a way of saying, no, wait, we really don't really need to do it in mm-hmm. that fashion. We mm-hmm. have other ways of being able to conduct mm-hmm. this research. Is fetal tissue absolutely necessary for some of this research, or is this is reopening up the whole conversation whether it should be used at all?
My understanding is that there really is no substitute for these really early cells. And that while you can grow cell lines from existing cell lines, so maybe that's causing less need to have new cell lines, there are some things you can only do with this. Now, I think that research advances all the time, and I don't know how this will evolve. It's certainly not my field, but the fact of the matter is if these tissues don't get used in these researches, they are incinerated, and that's that. So, you know, people might want to debate the morality of that, and that's certainly something that reasonable people might disagree about. But at this point, it exists, and it's helping save people, and it's making some women feel the tiniest bit better about a difficult situation in some of the places where that happens. And I think there's no actual real allegation here that Planned Parenthood is profiting from this or trafficking from this. If that were the case, nobody takes videotapes to Congress. They call the police. And to my knowledge, there's no law enforcement involvement in this in any of the 50 states. You know, the tapes themselves don't offer any credible evidence that this is it's a large industry of any kind or that there's any money behind it.
So as we went into the weekend, there still are some who would believe quite the contrary. Mm-hmm. What do you see playing out for this as you're talking with the National Planned Parenthood Federation mm-hmm. and other affiliates mm-hmm. of where, you know, in certain states like Massachusetts and Indiana, they've already been through this drill mm-hmm. and have been cleared of any wrongdoing or potential wrongdoing. But at the national level, in the national conversation, it keeps spinning out. Mm-hmm. Is there a definitive point where you think that this is not going to be a conversation about Planned Parenthood, but the government having to have a discussion about itself and what it's already authorized and reauthorized mm-hmm. For decades?
Well, I think that that's exactly the point. This obviously has more of a political feel to it than a factual feel. As we said, people don't take real, you know, if you think that there's a real wrong happening, you don't look at a videotape and wait for a month and then come back to it and dribble these things out weeks at a time. I think this is obviously theater for political purposes. I don't think it really opens a real debate. Planned Parenthood has called for a blue ribbon panel to look into the entire issue and follow the flow of the money and study this so that people can know what this is in the very most transparent way.
And when do you think that might happen?
Planned Parenthood has called for it. Congress so far has not agreed to do it. And I think that there would be a great deal of danger for Congress to agree to do it, because I think very early in the game, people would find out that there is not a lot of demand, there's no money, that receiving $30 so that you can prepare and ship a sample is not anything that's going to make anybody wealthy, and that this is ridiculous on its face.
Thank you so much for coming in. Wish we had more time to talk.
Thank you so much for having me.
Chris Charbonneau is the president and CEO of Planned Parenthood of the Great Northwest and the Hawaiian Islands.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we looked at the ever-expanding world of anime, the Japanese version of comic book art in Hawaii. The expanding art form has thousands of enthusiasts, or otaku, in Hawaii, in part because of an annual three-day celebration of anime culture that began in 2005 with an event at the Ala Moana Hotel that surprised organizers by its success. That first year, the convention attracted nearly 2,000 otaku. The most recent, at the Hawaii Convention Center, played host to more than 10,000. Its events included anime screenings, industry, fan and guest panels, costume play contests, masquerade competitions, art shows, concerts, dances, and video games. Next year's event is scheduled for April of 2016, and we can bet you'll be hearing a lot more about the 12th annual Kauai Con when the time comes. That's the answer to today's quiz, and it is 8:47. If you've got a quiz for us, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Stargazer Time, our weekly look at what's happening in the universe around our tiny planet and what to look for in our island skies. As usual, we turn to Christopher Phillips, Mauna Kea Astronomy Outreach Committee, and this week's report. Hey, Christopher, welcome back. What's going on?
Hello, Dave. Venus will be setting in the west during sunset around 6:50 p.m. Jupiter will follow suit, setting around about 7:24 p.m. But the ringed giant Saturn will be visible through the night until it sets shortly after midnight. Now, this week is perfect for stargazing, as our moon is going to be a mere crescent, leading to perfect stargazing conditions. This is especially important this week because we will see the peak of the Perseid meteor shower on Wednesday evening. This will be visible in the north.
What's in store for us?
Well, typically, as the week goes on, we'll see an increase in the amount of meteors, or shooting stars as they are more commonly known, in our island skies. The time when we can expect to see them most will be sometime around 1 a.m. on Wednesday.
What exactly is it that we're seeing?
Meteors, shooting stars, are tiny particles of dust traveling through space at incredible speeds, from around 25,000 miles per hour to an incredible 160,000 miles per hour.
And is that just a little tiny piece of dust, like smaller than your fingernail kind of thing?
Yeah, well, they come in all shapes and sizes. Some can be as big as a pebble, others as small as a grain of sand.
You're saying those streaks of light that you see in the sky that look so massive, caused by something that's smaller than your thumb?
Absolutely right. It's quite deceiving, the size of the trail. But the trails themselves are actually produced by our atmosphere burning as the meteor travels through it. The fast-moving meteor causes the air in front of it to become compressed. This compression and friction creates brilliant trails as the meteor makes its way through our night sky.
Is it just a trick of the eyes that it seems bigger, or how long is the streak?
Well, it's actually pretty long. Some of these streaks can be tens of kilometers long.
Oh, wow.
And that's, yeah, pretty incredible when you consider the thing that's making it is probably the size of a grain of sand.
When a larger one comes, it still creates that visual phenomena, or does it have a different thing?
Well, sometimes we get really lucky. If it's quite big, we end up with a fireball trail as opposed to just a streak of light. And these can be spectacular if you're lucky enough to see one.
And if they're really big, it wipes out the dinosaurs and stuff.
You got it absolutely right.
Nothing to joke about. We love our dinosaurs.
Of course.
Thank you very much for the report, Christopher. Appreciate it.
You are welcome, Dave.
Christopher Phillips, Mauna Kea Astronomy Outreach Committee. And I'm Dave Lawrence. Catch you next week for the report. Christopher Phillips, Mauna Kea Astronomy Outreach Committee. And you can find Stargazer on demand online at hawaiipublicradio.org. Just follow the news links.
Support for Stargazer comes from Ferraro Choi, providing environmentally sustainable architecture, interior design, and research for projects throughout Hawaii and the Pacific. FerraroChoi.com.
People from all over the world have made new lives for themselves in Hawaii. It's that kind of place. But the term melting pot might be inexact. It implies a loss of identity. And Hawaii's many different cultures have done much to keep their values, religion, and customs alive. Itamar Eichner is a reporter for Yediot Aharonot, the leading newspaper in Israel, who's been in Hawaii to write a piece about Jewish life in the islands. He's with us this morning. Good morning, Itamar.
Good morning, Chris.
Thanks for coming.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Pretty interesting time in Hawaii.
Yes, of course.
I would imagine.
Yeah, it's the first time for me here, and I'm quite astonished.
What were the first things that startled you that you saw?
Okay, I came immediately after I arrived here. I came to Emmanuel Temple on Sabbath evening for the ceremony, and it was quite amazing to see the Rabbi Ken Aharonovitz made a beautiful service and played an organ and ukulele and made the Jewish service as something that I never saw in my life, I think, in the aloha, or what the Jews here in Hawaii call shaloha. You know, it's a mixture of aloha and shalom,
Shalom, yeah.
Which is the Hebrew word for peace and greetings. So it was really amazing, and I never saw such an exotic Jewish community in the world.
Well, but it was, at the same time, it was true to the tradition, you felt?
It was different than what we know in Israel because it's a reform community. You know, the Judaism is being distributed to three branches. There is the reform, the conservative, and the orthodox. So in Israel, we are more familiar with the orthodox way, although we have reform and conservative. But usually in the Jewish diaspora, the reform and the conservative is much stronger than the Orthodox. So for me in Israel, for me as a, and I mean I'm a secular, but you know I'm more Orthodox than the other things. So I don't used to see women and men sit together in synagogue, for example, what is happening in conservative and in reform synagogue here in Hawaii and in other places in the world. So it's quite nice, by the way. I'm not against it. On the contrary, and this, you know, to make it more live and more modern, so the rabbi sings. And he takes the prayers and he revitalizes them. He makes it really something modern and very, very attracting. I wish my synagogue that I go here and there, I'm not going every day, will be like this. I think it's beautiful.
You have an interest in young people from around the world relocating, moving to Israel,
yes.
Changing their lives
yes.
and becoming Israeli citizens. Is there a lot of interest in young Jewish people around the world in that?
Yes, of course. There is an increase in the interest of young Jewish people all around the world to come to Israel. Israel, you know, is a melting pot of many, many communities and countries. You have Israelis that came from 70 or 80 countries abroad. And I think the youngsters today are more affiliated with Israel. They know they want to feel the Israeli experience. They come to Israel during their high school and with all kinds of programs. And some of them fell in love with the country. They see the Israeli youngsters, you know, and they want to try it. So they immigrate. Not all of them are staying. You know, some of them are doing a few years and then coming back to their origins. And even in the last years, there is an increase in the interest of young Jewish people from Hawaii to come to Israel. And I know a few. I spoke with a few. It's quite interesting, you know, to think that you should leave paradise on heaven in order to come to Israel. So it means that I really love Israel in order to, you know, to leave this place.
Well, I mean, you would have to, because it's a commitment that calls for you to really do some work.
Totally. I mean, if you are about the age of 18, you should recruit to the army. 3 years mandatory for men, 2 years mandatory for women. And you know that maybe the first element that drives those youngsters is to go to the army, to the IDF, to the Israeli Defense Forces. And they are so motivated, they want to go to combat units, which is something that's very popular with Israeli youngsters. You know, so why? I mean, they come from the diaspora in order to fight in Israel. So because, you know, in Israeli IDF, I mean, it's hard. It's not easy. It's not paradise.
Well, that's what I mean. I mean, that's a degree of commitment, right?
Totally, totally. The army service is not easy, and then you have problems, you know, to be absorbed in the society, to find job. First of all, to learn Hebrew, the language is. The first thing that newcomers to Israel, new immigrants, they go to Ulpan, which is the word like to first grade. Then they start learning Hebrew from the alphabet from scratch. And it's not only for youngsters. When immigrants come in the age of 60, 70, 80, they go to Ulpan, to this class.
And that's required. You're told you will be expected to learn the language.
Actually,
is that right?
Actually, it's not necessary. Uh-huh. Because in Israel, we are very open to other societies. So if somebody will ask you in the street in English or in French or in Russian, more likely that somebody will know one of the languages because he or his fathers came from there. So it will be easy to get along with. Of course, in English, 99% of the people will help you and will be so friendly to you that they will almost invite you to their homes.
But at the same time, it's a culture where it is important to keep the language alive. I guess that's what I'm saying.
I think so. And the modern Hebrew, by the way, is not. I mean, it's quite similar to the old Hebrew that is in the Old Testament, in the Bible. And the old Hebrew is quite a new language. I mean, because, you know, in the Bible you didn't have modern words. Mm-hmm. So the language is very important to us Israelis. We like it very much. And there is a thriving culture in Hebrew, thriving music in Hebrew. It's very interesting.
I think the thing that strikes me is that, you know, we tend to think of American youth culture as privileged and maybe even a little bit soft, which you wouldn't say about Israeli youth culture.
No, youngsters all around the world, I mean, they prefer English songs and, you know, American Idol. And, of course, it will be their first prefer. I mean, but still they value Jewish music. America, there is a big influence from America in Israel.
It's inescapable, isn't it?
We love it. I mean, we have a lot in common. I mean, actually, you're our biggest ally. You're our biggest friend. We can't stay there in the Middle East without the support of the United States. There is no doubt about it. Even if there are arguments between Netanyahu and President Obama, still, it's almost like in the family, you know?
Itamar, I'd very much like to see your story when you write it, yeah?
Yeah, I will send it to you.
Thank you. Itamar Eichner is a reporter for the Israeli newspaper Yediot Aharonot. He's working on a piece about Jewish life in the islands, and you can learn more about him and his work on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Today with such great conversations the way around. So we have just time enough to tell you that we're going to be back with you tomorrow morning, and we're going to take a look at the recently filed Maui cane burning injunction with attorney Lance Collins.
And we'll look ahead to the Hawaii Shakespeare Festival's production of Othello.
If you'd like to talk to us, you can call us anytime you like on our talkback line. That's 808-792-8217, or you can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
And if you missed any of this show or want a past one, you can find them on the HPR2 archive. Look under Talk Shows for the Conversation on HPR2.org. I'm Chris Vanderkirk.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll see you in the morning right here for more of The Conversation.